The theme for the afternoon talk is the meeting of love with emptiness. Told you. There are various themes in the Dharma of and exploration which frequently present a rather large challenge to us. Challenge not only to understand with our cognitions, with our mind, with our intellect, but also with our heart, with insight, and with our whole being. And sometimes, when it's the first time that we hear certain concepts, we are rather bemused, we are rather puzzled by them. And two of those which often present the biggest challenge, certainly in the initial periods of exploration, inquiry, and meditation, is the issue around self, non-self, of course, and the other one, of course, is emptiness. And it seems like these two rather strange and bizarre words suddenly appear from time to time in a Dharma talk or in a particular book. And quite understandably, we can find ourselves scratching our heads to what's all that about. And it doesn't seem to make a great deal of sense to our dearly developed Western mind, dare I say. So I'd just like to touch upon some little exploration here initially of emptiness, and then speak to you about the deep and profound significance of love, and the way one can help confirm and also reveal the other. And coming to the exploration of emptiness, on the basic, simple level, it genuinely is relatively simple. The actual word itself is emptiness, this is important here, emptiness of self-existence. And what I mean by that is that if you and I take anything in the world, both internally, that's in our psychology, in our consciousness, or consciousness, or in the material world, it might appear at times, and we might speak at times, as if it had its own self-existence, as it existed unto itself, for itself. And as human beings, there is a real vulnerability in this sheer diversity of things, ideas, views and beliefs, which strongly attract us, sometimes also magnetically, and we light upon it. We take it up, it, whatever it may be. And in the taking up of something, so to speak, idea, ideology, belief, views, goods, money, relationships, or whatever it might be. In the taking of it up, we then, understandably, invest that with significance. We can project or build more and more significance to us. To the point, as we all know, at times in our life, where that which we were pulled towards or attracted towards or held on to, in the end, seems to be oppressing us. That which made us happy to be connected with, it seems like later, as time goes by, whatever it is, has the potential to make us unhappy. And so we can find ourselves in our daily circumstances, here and elsewhere, moved backwards and forwards, so to speak, of a connection and relationship to life which at times is happy and at times is unhappy. That which gives us enjoyment also can give us a lot of anguish and frustration. And this can become the predominant view and dominant experience of life. And so the movement of the psychology of the inner life then matters more to us than anything else. How I feel about this, how I feel about that, how I view myself or view the other, that begins to take enormous priority. And that exploration of that when we're tied into that, we are not in touch with truth, we're not in touch with reality, we don't really understand what love is, and there's a disconnect from what emptiness is. And it could be very easy for us to make this journey through the field of existence, moving backwards and forwards at times between what we want and what we don't want, what we like and what we don't like, what we are pulled towards and what we resist and fight against. And that predominant psychology of the inner life, due to the contact with it, we then invest enough into it to say, this is the reality. This is the reality. It's a misplaced sense of reality. Take some digging with us in life to get to know what reality and truth is all about. So the appearances, the formations, which we've been touching upon here, the collision in the inner life, this and that, shall I or shan't I, good, bad, right, wrong, do, not do, all of that keeps colliding. There is a collision of this in the inner life. The collision gives more strength, so to speak, to the self, to the I, and we can find ourselves in a state of struggle. And this, so to speak, becomes our reality. If we allow ourselves, and it's an important invitation to ourselves, to question, is this the reality of things? The psychology, my makeup, and the dance, and the tensions that go with it. If this is an appearance of reality, how am I going to find what is deep and what is authentic, what is real? And it's a worthwhile invitation, it's a worthwhile exploration, because it may give access and it may, as it were, open our heart and mind and body up to the insignificance of emptiness and love, which is not caught in that field of for and against, the polarized, fragmented, agitated inner life. And in the taking of emptiness just for the moment, and appreciate, I'll have to hang in here for a little while because it will sound for some, I dare use that word, intellectual, but hang in. No. Sometimes we take the particular. It can be any mental, physical phenomena in this vast field of existence. And if we give the fullness of mindfulness to it, which is our practice and our exploration, it will become clear to us that this it which I give attention to, it might be called the breath or the body or the state of mind or certain goods or situations or people in my life. If I give the fullness of attention to it, the fullness of mindfulness to it, I realize I can't find anything with an essence to it. I can't. If I give the fullness of attention to it, if I just take this recorder here, just one item which is close at hand, and say, well, what is this recorder? And then I look at the recorder and I say, aha, this recorder consists of some metal, and it consists of some technology. It consists of various parts which have come together. And if I say, is this part the recorder? No, okay, I'll take that out. Is this part the recorder? No, I'll take that out. But this part, that part, etc. I cannot find the recorder. So the recorder is a word hanging, try not to fall asleep, but I really understand if you do. That the recorder is a word which is put to, so to speak, something there, but there is no something. There is no essence. It's a composition of multiple factors, including, in the case of the recorder, human ingenuity, a huge amount of work, probably on a global level, which has cooperated together to bring this here. I think this one started off in the mind of some human beings in Japan, and then from there it started to some travelling, and en route, from situation to situation, everybody involved wanted to make a little bit of money out of this recorder. Till it finally landed in some shop or online, and then this poor Waller had to pay about 250 euros for it. That restriction that there is, when I give a lot of attention to it with some holding on to, and I say, ah, this recorder is really important because it records. What it records may not be so good, but it does record there. And I add an extra factor to it, which is called mine, not yours, mine. And I add that on top of the recorder. The recorder has no idea it's mine. But I think it is. And I keep repeating it to myself. Gradually, the recorder becomes something, so to speak, isolated and separated from everything else that put it together. It becomes a thing. It ain't a thing. It couldn't be a thing. It couldn't have an essence to it. It's a composite of these countless causes and conditions. And the Buddha's comment on this, or reference in this way, is to say it is emptiness. It is empty of its own existence. And suffering in the world, anguish and frustration, is through the human tendency to exaggerate the importance. It has a relative usefulness. I call it a recorder. I call it my recorder, which all of which is fine. But if I understand in the deep of the being that actually it's not mine, and it's not a recorder in some essential way, it's a composite of the conditions. If I remember it's a composite of a whole variety of conditions, and it's clearly understood, you've understood emptiness. The one way that one can know, sometimes people say, listen, I haven't forgotten love. It's actually the main part of the talk. Don't go away. Well, you can if you like, but weather's lousy out there. So, sometimes in the view, in the perception, in this case, say, of the exploration of things, like with other things, sometimes as we listen, we say, it just sounds intellectual. If it is intellectual, which it may be, even sometimes for it to be even intellectual is going somewhere, because for some, remember when I would listen to these things from my dear teacher, if it was intellectual, I thought I had a good day, because sometimes it wouldn't even get here. Now, I left school at 15, you know, so there's not too much upstairs. So sometimes it would go right over the head. And if I actually landed in the head, I thought, man, that's really cool. But often it just go over. Then I'd listen again, and I'd listen again. Ah, my brain cells, the cognition, the wheels are turning. It took a long time, but the wheels are turning, and a little more comprehension is coming in. And I keep meditating on it again, keep reflecting. Because how can you argue with it? How could one argue that this isn't made up of causes and conditions? If it had an essence in it, it really had an inherent essence, it couldn't die. It couldn't break up. It couldn't fall apart. The essence would mean that it's independent of all the causes and conditions. There'd be something in there called an essence. Strip this thing apart, we won't find it. And sometimes the understanding of that just gets a little bit deeper. When it gets a little bit deeper, we begin to understand more clearly the dynamics of life, the formations of life, and a very simple one, very simple truth. It's very simple. Nothing is worth clinging to because it's got no essence. Because it's made up of causes and conditions, because it's empty of its own thingness. Yeah. Sip of water and we'll come to love. I might say one or two things which may raise one or two eyebrows. There, I'll be very happy. So, if I look, I may look at another human being, I may look at a flower, I may look at a recorder, I may look at, so to speak, myself. And if, in what was said to you previously, that the formations come together, multiple diversity, quite extraordinary, just the sheer diversity, but which, whatever I put attention to, it's, as it were, so to speak, coming from everything else. But that everything else which is coming from, the good team in Japan, the ship owners, the travellers, the shop, that is also coming from everything else. And so it goes on, this multiple coming from everything else, so to speak. If it doesn't have its own inherent existence, I know I've said it three or four times, I won't apologize though. So if it doesn't have its own inherent existence, no essence, could it be possible that in its orderliness, that communication with another human being, that small engagement, that small event, therefore has some remarkable potential, not to just say, oh, it's just causes and conditions in some cold Buddhist voice, which there are plenty around, but say that actually allows the potential to be seen with incredible potential. If it's nothing of itself, nothing of itself means that the communication, the relationship, the interaction has, I'm not underestimating this, infinite potential. Because it's nothing in itself. And that connection with that then brings into what is love. What is love? Is love, which also has no inherent existence, which also is an expression of causes and conditions, inwardly and outwardly. And can the love meet with the emptiness there, in which, in that dynamic, it brings something out of the being, it brings something out of us. In the talk when Lila was talking earlier on today, if your mind is wandering and you've long gone, no problem. That the Buddha is speaking, this is an important aspect here, in the discourse and in the closing lines of the discourse, speaking about cessation, of which there are various ways to do that. I'll explore it now. Sometimes I look at a situation, whatever it might be, and I say to myself, or it comes as an insight to me, this which has been going on before, which is difficult and troublesome, this must stop now. And inner authority can come. It may be in that kind of way I just spoke, or it may come as a realization there. And sometimes there are situations in our life where we clearly know that it requires from us a break with the past. Whatever that might be. And I'm sure probably all of us in the room at some point in our life have looked at the way things are going, or possibly the direction they are going in. We've looked at that and we have said to ourselves, enough is enough. And there is a break. It could be a habit or an addiction or painful circumstances or an unhappy job or countless things. That break, when the being has the capacity to make the necessary break with the old, which is language here, to bring it to cessation, that break with the old is the confirmation that, in Dharma language, of seeing the truth. And seeing the truth. Many kinds of way of seeing the truth. I may look at a situation. I really want it to change. I don't want to go on feeling like this, or living like this, or continuing like this. The thought keeps circulating around. I make some small, petty little efforts to change it, but nothing really changes. So I continue knowing something needs to change, but it doesn't change. And the reason it doesn't change, because one has not seen the truth of the situation. And therefore the mindfulness itself really would have enough power or the concentration to actually make a break with the unsatisfactory and unhealthy past. Because it doesn't have its own existence. So what is the movement in life which, where you and I recognize we need to make the break with the past, small things and big things, all included, in which there is the movement to make the break with the past, because in the break with the past, two things become clear. We've seen the truth of the situation, and we've freed ourselves up. We may not know what we're going to, but we certainly are clear what we're going from. We may be left in a major unknown and somewhat insecure feeling there, but one thing, we've seen the truth of something, we're clear about it, and we've moved on. This movement, and this willing to make the change, is called love. This is love. In the exploration of love, which is one of the most powerful and liberating forces for our species. The interest in love, in a way, needs to be foremost and paramount in our life. It's one of the great acts or circumstances of human beings, and of course other creatures as well. What I mean by that is, if I take a real interest in love and explore the nature of love, the causes and conditions that bring it about, it will act and serve us as a real reference point for every form of human activity. The love, the power of the love, will contribute directly to it. And you may raise your eyebrows at this point. Hang in. There are many different kinds of love. Kindness and friendship and warmth and generosity and giving. I regard the most powerful form of love as romantic love. It's the love which endures, it stays, it's an incredible communicator of truth, and it has an authority to it which is quite extraordinary. Unfortunately, in certain circles, I think it's called religion, and in other circles as well, there can be a neglect of the understanding of the power of this kind of love. Or, this kind of love sometimes gets viewed and looked upon as, in that famous Buddhist mantra, it won't last. Oh well, have a nice day, it won't last. And this kind of rather lightweight and superficial view of romantic love hasn't understood the deep significance of it. There. Even at the most the expression of it in its creative sense, in the creative sense. How much of our literature, the poets, the artists, the theatre, the cinema, the novels, what percentage of culture, rich, creative, imaginative culture, what percentage of it has some story weaved in to it about love and romantic love? Even those appalling soap operas, with all the misery that every one of them seems to succeed in communicating, weaves in it about romantic love. It's such a potent energy with life that I say this love has an enduring element to it. And sometimes in life, I just say a little bit here, it's so significant that quite often in change and in moving on, particularly quite often when it's romantic love with all the closeness, it is one of the hardest areas to adjust to. In my years of listening to people, two friends cannot see each other and they have an argument and they separate from each other. Sometimes, of course, it's, you know, parents and children, they kind of argue and angry and get cut off from each other, and certain other kind of social contacts. But quite often, it's in the area of romantic love, which, when there has been closeness and passion and eros and intimacy, quite often, that one causes even in a very short meeting, some of the most anguish. There's something significantly extraordinary about it. And I'm not talking just in the area of relationship. I'm talking about making romantic love. One doesn't have to be in a relationship for this. As a theme of love and a theme of a way of life, because it helps to carry with it adventure and enjoyment, the very romance of life. And quite often, the people that you and I have much respect for and love for and really appreciate their way of life, though she or he may not use the language here would be of that order of living a romantic way of life. So when in the past, people have an engagement with life which carries with it something fresh and something new, and therefore the breaks with the past, or just inviting something new into the life, it carries the order of something romantic about it. And the romantic element can stay strong, and in the deep, in a way it doesn't in other areas. Sometimes, probably most of us have been in relationship at some point or other. And one of the mantras I've been told in my love life is along the lines, the one-liner is, I love you, Christopher, but you're never around. So there's presence and there's absence, and one hopes that the love between the presence and absence will endure. Well, in my case, clearly it didn't. So there's the coming together, there's the apart, there's the coming together and the apart. And a little while ago, one of my comings together and going apart, and the good friendships stayed, so she gave me a ring, and we were talking on the phone, and she said, "Oh, Christopher, you know, how are you? How's life?" And I asked her, "How's life?" She said, "Oh, Christopher, I'm in a new relationship, and he's a really nice guy there, but she said, I miss those," which is true, "long conversations that we used to have. We used to go right into the night, right through the night." And of course, I also miss them, because it takes two to tango. So the good lady says to me in the first place, "I love you, Christopher, but you're never around." And then she contacts me later on and said, "I really love those long conversations we had." And somewhere I'm kind of piggy in the middle, you know, trying to navigate this. I mention all of this. For me, it's a confirmation, even in togetherness and apart, and in the different roles, from lovers, shall we say, to friendship, that in the deep of the being, something of love endures. Really endures. And this enduring love, when it's deep, the depth of it can allow one role or one identity to appear, another one for it to go, a fresh one to appear, and even that one to go, because the identity, I am this and you are that and we are this, the identity is not the uppermost factor, it's a way of describing how we are with the other. But in the deep, the love endures. And no change in role, no presence or absence can destroy that love. Therefore I say love is powerful, it's very, very deep, and it's much more important than just the sense of identity with somebody. And therefore, in the understanding of the emptiness of things, in the going deep into ourselves there, with all the respect that's required, it can allow identity, role, to flow and ebb and change without the cost of the love. If in the relationship of cessation or ending, sometimes we look at our life, it's been part of the dialogue which has been taking place here, and in the looking at our life, I can't imagine a human being feeling completely fulfilled unto himself or herself. I just can't imagine it. Because there's no self-existence. If there was self-existence, and I had a real essence to me, I had that religious word, a soul, and it was pure, and perfect, and unchanging, and it was somewhere, I never actually found one, but somewhere in here, this soul, then I found that, now my life is complete. I've found my soul, and I've got it, and it's with me forever, or whatever. So the view can be, I've found that, I've got my essence. But in the dance of body, perceptions, feelings, thoughts, experiences, and consciousness, I can't see any essence. Causes and conditions, I hesitate to use the word, coming together. So I can't imagine in this dance of being human, human being can say, I'm completely fulfilled unto myself. I haven't met anybody who might say it for an afternoon, but generally it doesn't last. But equally, this is the important part here, I look to the other. And sometimes, naturally enough, what I might be lacking inside of myself, I feel empty about, not emptiness, just empty about, there. I may well, all too humanly, look for what's absent here to be there. Why not? Got to look somewhere, why not? Don't think there's anything wrong with it, I don't think to make a fuss about it. So sometimes, the nourishment comes, something is missing here, and I get, and the nourishment comes from there. I think this, human life. I don't believe in this utterly fulfilled self-existence nonsense. So in that interaction there, but as I get to know her or him, I will have to get to know what is missing in her or him. Understand? I know myself and say, this is how I am, but this is missing in me. But she, or he, or they, something there is present, and I can benefit from that. We have a very good friend, Benoit. Benoit is actually lovely, lovely guy there. And I absolutely love him to bits. And he's also a master of computers. He knows computers. These things come together. And he's been in my house. He's a master. And he also, unusually, has a long ponytail right down to the bottom of his back. He's French Canadian. And I've said to a few of my friends, sometimes I wish I was a gay man. And he was gay. I would fall in love with him. I'd fall in love with his incredible capacity with computers. So you get what I mean. Right. So, but then, as one gets to know the other, with all the appreciations which come from her or him, if you get to know what is present, you will get to know what is not present. You have to. Because life is present and absence. So look at myself and say, well, this is missing in my life. I use the computer expert knowledge, for example. I mean, there's plenty more, but it's the one that's most comfortable to talk about. So, wicked. So, recognize something is lacking here, and quite naturally enough, I will go to the other and see it is present there, and with the love, it can flow easily and freely. But as I get closer to myself, I'm clear, but equally, as I get close to her or him or them, I'd be clear as well. What she or he has to share, to offer, but what she or he doesn't have. And if I imagine she or he can provide me with everything, I'm out to lunch. I've lost the plot. Because life has no self-existence to it. Meaning that sometimes, back to the romantic love for a moment, the sense of life and love and the romantic love carries with it the adventure. So sometimes, if I feel I am missing something there, I may have an idea, which may be true, of what I'm missing, but I may have to ask myself, given what the poets remind us, is there enough creativity in my life? Is the life creative? And the creativeness of life, our willingness to be creative, moves the life in a fresh way, and I say that creative expression of life, I say, this is a romantic way of life. This is to be nourished. To ask ourselves. And now, great, beautiful aspects of our culture do mirror and reflect, remind us of the beauty of a creative way of life. And therefore, I can be with the other, whoever he or she may be. I can see what can be shared and offered. And I'm not naive. I don't think I, as a human being, have everything I can offer to the other. I don't think she or he or they has everything they can offer to me there. But I see, recognize that. And I don't find myself being judgmental and angry and upset because I'm not getting what I want. Because I understand the other as a composite of causes and conditions. When I was in the monastery, some people have an idea. They say, oh, it must be so nice living in a monastery. Clueless these people are. They're living on another planet. And you live in a monastery, you don't have to worry about money, you don't have to cook food there, and you're surrounded by all this metta, which you're not, loving kindness around. Oh, it must be just like a little bit of Garden of Eden, a little bit of heaven on earth. I tell you, if you're living in the same little area, just imagine, here, about altogether, how else, 80 of us, let's say, and you're living here, 365 days a year, 24/7, with 80 people who you never chose to live with. You didn't select and say, oh, please come and live because you're so lovable and likable and kind. No. A whole bunch of rather bizarre men and women with shaved heads and orange curtains thrown together, doing some kind of weird practice there. Morning, noon and night there. You think it's peace and harmony? You think the stresses don't build up? Boy, I have to live with that round the clock. And We did in the monastery every afternoon from 3 to 4:30, walking meditation in a large circle. It's all oneness. Unity and harmony. So walk in this circle, about 100 monks. And then the nuns on the other side of the Dharma hall would be sitting on the other side of the, walking on the other side in their circle. So we're doing this walk. It's a circle. There is nowhere to go. It's a circle. But one bloody monk decides he is going to walk so slowly, which puts him at the front of the line, because the slower you are, you're at the front. So the gap between him and the one in front gets bigger and bigger, and we're all piled up around the back of this monk. Walking, you know, it takes 5 minutes to take a step. Yeah. We get upset, we get angry, but we're not going anywhere. We're going in circles. And sometimes the monks would get so agitated, they would walk out the line, walk up the front, say to this monk, "Get off! You're holding us up!" This is called stress. You go to the meditation hall in the evening, there. And, it's patriarchal, it's Buddhism. And you've got the monk, you've got the teacher sitting actually at a high chair, there. And then you've got the senior monks in the front rows, and then the junior monks, then you've got the novices, and then you've got the nuns, this is the patriarchal bit there. And one is sitting on a wooden floor, with those little bamboo mats on. If you've been ordained for a few years, you get a little piece of square carpet to sit on for your backside. That's because you've been ordained several years. The rest of us on bamboo mat on the floor. With a Dharma hall with no windows. Sitting there with shaved head and shaved eyebrows. There. And mosquitoes thinking Christmas has come early. Dancing around on their head, having the meal of their life, knowing there's no violence, no threat to their existence. And you hear this buzzing around their heads, and furthermore, here, like the good lady here and others, you know, here, front row, you can just put your feet out and point them to the front. You know, we don't care. But you can't do that in Buddhist monasteries. It's considered, for some bizarre reason, rude to put the feet out with the feet, soles of the feet, because the soles of the feet get a bit dirty on the ground, so you're not allowed to put them out to the front. What the hell are you going to do with your legs when they're in pain when you can't put them out in front? And so you're sitting there. I mean, at least we are polite. We do arrive on time within a few minutes. But they don't have... It's timeless. The teacher turns up when he feels like it. So when sitting there, being eaten alive, waiting for a teacher to turn up, but who's not particularly interested. And in all of this, there's all the agitations which are going on. But something, and I couldn't even speak Thai, so it's not like, anyway. But there's something in the deep which keeps one steady with it. Something, despite everything, the pain in the knees and the mosquitoes and the wandering mind and the doubt, what the hell am I doing here? You know, I could be somewhere else having a good joint. No, one is in it, but what's in the deep keeps one steady. One is keeping faithful to something. This being faithful to is love. It's love. Love is the enduring element despite all the that goes on. And that same power and principle of the enduring of love there can apply in relationships, in fields of creativity, in work, in human service, in the engagement with life, and of course love of the Dharma, love of the practice. And that recognition of that and that connection with that makes love the precious, powerful force. And so sometimes when we meet with other, or we meet with a place or environment, we will say, we will use the language, I just love spending time with her or him. I just love being with the children. I just love being in the nature. I just love looking at the stars above. I just love reading these particular poems or whatever. So the movement of the love, and it finds a whole variety of expressions, and that variety of expressions, to me, is the confirmation of a romantic way of life. It's got no limits to it, because truth has no limits to it. It's vast and it's extensive, because reality is vast and extensive. It has immense potential to bring out joys and happiness with us. And the love of that exploration will give the authority in life to stand on one's own feet as best we can. We are not afraid of life, and we're going to be as close to truth as we can. And that sometimes that being close to truth is that sometimes we need to be very honest with ourselves, and that sometimes requires from us a real change. A real change. If we explore all of that without forgetting, and finally, just without forgetting, because there is no self-existence, no inherent existence, it makes everything possible. It is so dynamic what we are living in. The very dynamic of life has its own vitality, its own wonder about it, and we are part of it. We belong in all of this. Let's not let our life be overshadowed with habits. Let's not be a prisoner to our history, our past. Let's not be stuck with the old. Let's find the love in deep inside, which really connects and is intimate and is close and is adventurous. And to give that priority, because in that respect, we pay great respect to ourselves, and also, and equally, we pay great respect to each other. And with our love, we pay great respect to life. Let's have a quiet minute, shall we? May all beings engage in the exploration of life. May all beings live with love. May all beings appreciate how the emptiness of a self-existence makes everything extraordinarily possible. Thank you for lending me. Thank you very much.